And welcome to CITR 101.9. My name is Alex DeBoer, and we are broadcasting from UBC on the unceded Musqueam territory in Vancouver, British Columbia. You're listening to Lady Radio, which is a program brought to you by the Women's Collective at CITR. Lady Radio is a talk show meant to highlight the voices of self-identified women. Today we have a special guest on the show. Her name is Molly Lewis. Molly completed her master's in UBC's Film Studies program a year ago, and she wrote her honors thesis on the popular television show Mad Men. Her thesis is titled The Circuitry of Memory, Time and Space in Mad Men. She has spoken at such film and television conferences as SCMS National Conference in Atlanta and the PCA ACA Annual National Conference in New Orleans in 2015, and she's been published in Boyhood Studies, an interdisciplinary journal, and the Federation for Humanities and Social Sciences. So thank you for joining us, Molly.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And so today we're going to be talking about Molly's honors thesis, The Circuitry of Memory, Time and Space in Mad Men, as I mentioned. But before we begin, I would like to just disclose that while I am a fan of Mad Men, I'm not an expert, and I haven't seen every episode, and I have nowhere near the knowledge that Molly does, and probably a lot of viewers are in the same boat, so I was just hoping that you could, first of all, maybe explain a bit about Mad Men, the show, for those who haven't seen it. Yeah, that'd be great.
Well, Mad Men premiered in 2007. The showrunner, Matthew Weiner, is very much the creative genius behind the show. In fact, a lot of my thesis dealt with him in terms of his point of view and how that's expressed in the show and how he shaped the characters. It finaled last summer, which was perfect timing for my thesis. I chose to write on Mad Men when I entered the master's program in 2013, and I actually didn't know when the show was going to end. Okay. So it was perfect that it finaled right in the middle of me finishing my third and final chapter on the series, so it could not have been any better. The show is about Donald Draper, whose real name is actually Dick Whitman. He became Donald Draper in the Korean War when his comrade was shot down and he stole his identity. So very much like, you know, Great Gatsby, those kind of American archetype characters, he starts his life over as a new person. Yeah. And that's what the show follows, especially the kind of unraveling of Don Draper's life as people begin to realize, and very slowly, that he is indeed not the man he says he is. And it's set in the 1960s, which is the most important thing to mention, I guess.
Yeah.
I love the 60s, and that is definitely what attracted me to the show in the first place.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. The 60s is definitely an alluring decade for many of us, I think. So I can relate to that, definitely. So I have some questions.
Yes.
In the show, we're going to be talking a lot about memory, as the title of your thesis gives away, is obviously a crucial focus of yours, and how your thesis relies on the idea that the human mind's memory expands vertically and horizontally along planes of memory, and essentially, more simply put, it's subjective. Memory is subjective. And one line you used that I appreciated was how Mad Men kind of proves that proves the inadequacy of the clock in the calendar. Also another way of saying what I just said, basically. So I was just hoping you could explain sort of what you mean by that and how that concept is so central to your work and your thesis.
Yeah, well, I was really, how I came up with these concepts about memory, I have to give credit to Henri Bergson, who's a early 20th century philosopher, French philosopher.
Okay.
And his whole concept was that the past coexists with the present. So when we talk about memory, that's kind of the way that the past does exist with the present, that we're always bringing the past along with us through the function of memory. And in terms of what you said, quoting my thesis, which is so weird to hear. Essentially, in Mad Men especially, viewers are provoked to think about the past because it's set in the 60s. So we often think about the past that way. And in that way, time is compressed and that we're transported back to the past, even the idea of the past. For those of us who didn't grow up in the 60s, we still have a concept of it. So the show literally makes the past our present. And then on top of that, in terms of the subjective memory, we have Dawn, who has these troubled memories of his past mm-hmm. that come and interrupt his life at various points, demonstrating that we can never escape the past.
Right.
So when we talk about time not being measured by a clock, right? That's mm-hmm. the idea that time can go by in an instant, but
yeah.
then through memory, it can seemingly last forever.
Right.
And things can be remembered constantly.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And yeah, I was going to ask you about Henri Bergman, but I'm glad that you mentioned him and the whole idea of the past coexisting with the present. To move to a slightly different focus, I also, one thing I learned about while reading your thesis was this idea of, or the, just the term quality television. So you discuss Mad Men as a long form, what it is, a long form serialized television show, mm-hmm. which is referred to as quality television. And so I was just wondering to you, what does quality television offer that is different than, I don't know how to say it, but like non-quality television or non-serialized television.
Usually it's compared to network.
Network,
kind of like prime time, sitcom, mm-hmm. you know, How I Met Your Mother, Big Bang Theory,
right.
kind of.
Which has no end, kind of, right? Like it kind of goes, it's
Yeah, it's
planned.
Very episodic in
yes.
nature, right? And especially if you think of, like, The Simpsons, for example, is frozen in time. The next episode
right.
starts and you kind of forget what's happened.
Yeah,
it's not building
key.
On a narrative the way that quote-unquote quality television shows do,
right.
although I should mention that's kind of a contested term in my field because
it
distinguishes that, like, some TV is better than others.
Right.
And I don't,
yeah.
I use that a lot in my thesis, especially if we're talking about Mad Men, because it's seen as this sort of second golden age of television, of these shows
yeah.
on HBO and AMC, mm-hmm. these, like, premium cable networks. Right, that
mm-hmm.
can have the time, no commercial breaks or whatever, right, that are just
mm-hmm.
different than what we see on episodic kind of network television, right? But essentially, it implies that this TV is better, and I'm not
yeah.
saying that because so much TV is good. Like, I love trashy reality television. I
totally.
Think it's just as complex as a show like Mad Men. Maybe that's controversial to say, but there's
yeah.
definitely a lot to think about. But in terms of Mad Men, I like to use that term to really imply the serial form,
mm-hmm.
and this goes back to, like, Dickens, Victorian literature mm-hmm. that was released in installments that built on these massive stories over a long period of time, right? Mad Men took 8 years to tell its story.
Yeah.
So when I say long form, I really mean long form and things that happened in season 7 reference season 1. So
mm-hmm.
especially Matthew Weiner and his long form storytelling really
mm-hmm.
built upon things from season to season. And that's
yeah.
something I found interesting because that implicates memory.
He
imagined, or at least hoped, that his viewers would watch every season
yeah.
and stay with him and notice these
mm-hmm.
little minor connections that he forged. And quality television is
mm-hmm.
known for that. Breaking Bad especially had these
yeah.
little moments that people and the fans would freak out about that you had to be a careful watcher to notice.
Right.
And that's where that
mm-hmm.
quality comes from. You have to be tuned in, really alert when you're watching.
Mm-hmm.
Or you might not be so alert watching your average reality TV show, I would say. I can at least admit that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's... Yeah, I was gonna also talk about how you mentioned in your thesis that Mad Men and shows like The Wire or Breaking Bad, other quality television and critically acclaimed shows, have been compared and likened to novels in Victorian literature. But I guess you sort of explained that mostly in that it's like serialized and takes place over an expanse of time.
I also like the reading metaphor.
Right.
The idea that you're not passively watching, but
yes.
you're kind of reading the show. You have to really pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
And you might have to not just watch once, but watch twice. Reread, reexamine, reinterpret.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I felt that Mad Men especially provoked that in its viewers.
Absolutely, yeah. And that leads nicely into my next question, which is about TV consumption practices, which you talked about in your thesis. And so with the idea of, you know, being a careful viewer and perhaps reading a show and revisiting it, as you say, to pick up on small details. So obviously in today's age of Netflix, we have the opportunity as viewers, if you want to put it that way, to consume shows according to our own chosen consumption pacing. So people can, as you mentioned in your thesis, binge watch like an entire series in 2 days or 1 week. Or some people might stop watching an episode in the middle of it and then, you know, leave that show for a month, watch something else and come back to it. All these things that are very interruptive of the formal sort of way of ingesting and like observing shows and films as well. So I was going to ask you how these new opportunities in TV consumption are specifically relevant to Mad Men and how they might help or hinder the watching of the show.
Yeah, well, I definitely argued in my thesis that it hindered the show mm-hmm. to an extent. Now the show is on Netflix, so right. for those who haven't seen it and are interested in what we're talking about, yeah. you can definitely watch the entire series. It will be a lot of fun. But initially, I don't think that's how Matthew Weiner imagined his show to be consumed.
Yeah.
And I say this with some confidence because I've heard him speak about it in a couple different interviews.
Right.
And that he likes the kind of week-long break that
yeah.
Broadcast television provides mm-hmm. and that it gave you time to kind of think about the show, to let it sink in, to absorb yeah. it before you saw the next episode. And even though when I was writing my thesis, I would binge watch the show. I much have watched the whole series about like five times
yeah.
over, right?
Because wow.
I was writing on it. yeah. So definitely I would binge watch it. But I think in terms of watching it live in that last seventh season, it was kind of exciting to be
yeah.
forced to wait. And that's something that I think our generation is not used to as so much anymore.
Yeah.
We want to have like the entire season available at once, the way that Netflix releases shows like Orange is the New Black,
yep.
which can be great and exciting. But I do find, especially when I watched Master of None, like when that came out,
yes.
All those episodes just blurred into one in my yep. mind. And I don't feel like, as much as I enjoyed it, I don't know if I got as much out of it
mm-hmm.
as if I had watched each episode every week and had time to discuss it with my friends, to read about
yeah.
each episode on the internet, as Mad Men had a huge internet following in terms
mm-hmm.
of people, you know, taking apart little bits and pieces of each episode
yep.
before the next one would air. So in a way, binge watching can hinder the way that stories are told.
Yeah.
Because a show like Mad Men really required the pause to think about, oh, what's going to happen next, and also reflect on what's happened, especially to the main character, Don Draper, so far
mm-hmm.
in the series.
Yeah. But yeah, so while it can be a hindrance, it at the same time does help in the sense that if you want to rewatch and revisit, even specific episodes or parts of episodes in a past era, you couldn't do that, right? You couldn't
mm-hmm.
just, you know, there was no option of like buying a television show. You could, I guess, record it perhaps on VHS or something, but you'd have to have a lot of VHS tapes, you
yeah.
know, eventually after six seasons of Mad Men. It's six, right?
Seven. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, seven seasons
of Mad Men. Even more VHS tapes would be necessary.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But so Netflix, in a way, helps people be careful readers of the show, but also kind of stops them maybe from
yeah,
pausing.
I think, and broadcast networks, they're embracing that, right?
Mm-hmm.
AMC will yeah. replay the episode throughout the week.
Oh,
so
yeah.
even though it wasn't all on Netflix right away, they would at least replay the same episodes. You'd be like, oh, I want to see that again. In fact, when they played their finale, they played the finale episode and then immediately started the episode over again.
Really?
As soon as it finished on AMC, which was I thought was really unique, because it's them saying, you don't have to, like, you have to literally watch it twice. Like,
yeah.
they're suggesting that you watch it twice, because as
yeah.
soon as the credits finish, it just starts over
yeah.
again, which is saying, like, you probably missed something.
Yeah.
In your first viewing.
Yeah.
And as I found rewatching the show, there were so many things I missed.
Yeah.
And it's so subtle
sure.
in its storytelling and so dense. And
mm-hmm.
I think a lot of shows require that kind of attention now.
Yeah.
And I think viewers are a little bit more open to that intellectual challenge, especially when they can do it on their own time. So maybe you're not watching all the episodes live, but when you have that moment at home to access it online or see a
yeah.
replay on AMC, it's kind of nice to then get into that moment and actually like intelligently watch the show and think about it before the next episode.
Yeah, absolutely. While reading your thesis, one thing I found that was interesting was a scene you brought up, which is from the episode Out of Town, which, I don't know, is that second season, I think?
First season.
Oh,
no, opening episode of season three. Yes,
okay,
I
there
think.
You go.
Maybe I'm
you know
wrong, should be on the internet looking it up right now, but yes,
yeah,
I'm
no,
pretty sure my
I should
memory
have,
serves
included
me right.
It. But yeah, so in that episode, there's an example of a flashback, which is a common thing that happens in Mad Men, where there are flashbacks to, I think, exclusively Don Draper's past. And so what's particularly striking about this one to me is that in this quote-unquote flashback, Don witnesses his own conception, birth, and delivery, as you say. And these are all obviously events that he could not have actually been present for, or, I mean, he was present for his birth, but he could never have remembered that. No one remembers their birth, right? So how does this sequence of events in this flashback disrupt or build on what you're saying about the significance of flashbacks, considering that these memories in this particular case aren't actually memories of his?
Yeah, well, that's something I struggled with, because the term flashback can't really apply to that. Because, again, usually in a flashback, there's some kind of, like, the most cliche example would be, like, All About Eve. Like, you know, the character voiceover, and then, ooh, watery camera work. All of a sudden, we're in a different era, a different time. Oh, it's years ago, right? Mm-hmm. And with Mad Men, we don't get that at all. What's interesting about that scene is that he watches his conception, birth, and delivery all in the same space of his kitchen, his present kitchen in 1960s, in his home in Ossining, which is very strange. Mm-hmm. But what that demonstrated to me was this idea that even though we rely on memory of our lives, right, that other things can become part of our memory that aren't things we actually experience, like that I was talking about with our, like, idea of the 1960s. Mm-hmm. Even though he wasn't remembering his birth, he still has the concept of it in his mind, because at some point somebody reiterated these events to him down the line and it became part of his memory. Right. It's kind of like when you are thinking about your childhood. I do this a lot with my sister, right? She's like, oh, do you remember this? And I'm like, well, I think I do, but maybe I just remember the picture.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily crystal clear in your mind, but it's become part of your life story that you carry around with you.
Yeah.
But I couldn't use the word flashback in that instance, right? Mm-hmm. Especially because of the way the scene was constructed. They don't literally go back anywhere. It's happening in the present moment. And that's when I turned to philosophy to answer the question in terms of what's the purpose of the scene? What can we call it? And especially Bergson, but also Gilles Deleuze, who was a French philosopher in the 60s, he had this whole idea of a time image. And I thought, oh, that's much more what this is. It's an image of time. Yeah. It's like a marker of Don's life. But it's also this image that opens up all this memory and emotion for him. Yeah. And it's something that you can ponder. And I mean, the time image is hard to summarize briefly. Yeah. But essentially, it's something much more unique and philosophical and abstract in nature than a straightforward flashback. And I saw the show using a lot of that kind of technique, that kind of time imagery, that especially in moments of Dawn where he's experiencing a really subjective mental moment.
Yeah.
And that's what I identified throughout my thesis. And that scene was a really important one.
Yeah. Yeah. The idea of time image. Yeah. And you also created your own term called telesign.
Yes.
Yeah. Which is specific to television. But you've taken it from a term that's supposed to be applied to, or was applied to, film.
So yeah, by Deleuze, who I just mentioned.
By Deleuze, yeah. So what is that exactly?
Yeah, well, he has all these different kind of time images, so they all have sign in them, although these are English translations, right? He has the chrono sign, for example, like time sign. Anyway,
okay.
I just like the idea of a telesign because he never wrote about television explicitly, because cinema was dominating, obviously, in the 60s. So I've kind of decided to be like, well, when we see a time image in a TV show, it's a different context, so therefore it deserves its own definition. Mm-hmm. Actually, my thesis supervisor, Brian, was like, you got to put the telesign in your thesis title. So I was just thinking about him now, like, Molly.
Yeah.
But it's hard to explain. I think one of the reasons I didn't throw it in my title is that I wanted it to be recognizable to people. Like,
yeah.
Be like, what's that? Huh? What? Like, I wanted it to be Googleable too, right?
Yeah.
But definitely, it's just more this idea that we can have these complex images that induce thought. That was really Deleuze's idea, was that you can think, it's like it opens this whole world up to you. He talked a lot about the work of Ozu, the Japanese director, who had these pillow shots. So it's like just a really basic shot of a vase, but it fills you with all this emotion. There's all this stuff going on in terms of the narrative, but also what opens up for the viewer. And I felt that that definitely was applicable to Mad Men, in terms of having these moments like with Dawn just staring at a lighter, where it seems so simple, but I think especially for really avid viewers, that was like a huge moment. And it's also a huge moment in the narrative, right?
Yeah.
So it becomes, the viewer definitely becomes implicated.
Yeah.
Because we're thinking about the lighter and the significance and when we last saw it in the show, just as Dawn is at the same time.
Yeah. And it sort of seems like it's a bit of a reward to understand a small moment like that.
Yeah.
Because not if you just were to turn on the show randomly, you wouldn't know why it's meaningful that Don's gazing at his lighter.
Oh, totally. And what that Mad Men was always accused of being boring, even though it was very critically acclaimed.
Yeah.
I read a lot of stuff of people, it's so boring. Nothing happens, right?
Right.
People on blogs, too. Like, that was a boring episode. It's like, you're not watching carefully enough because there are things happening. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't have these bursts of actions the same way as a show like Breaking Bad did, right? Where you're like, they had the fly episode where, like, some people were, that was so boring. What was with that? But then they would reward viewers in a really big way with a lot of stuff happening. Mad Men had a slow burn. And I think it definitely rewarded viewers who were patient and who really embraced the show for all it was.
Yeah, and I guess that's another crucial part of this long-form, serialized form of television where the episodes exist as a whole, not in part. So, yeah, very interesting. Well, I was going to ask you about how thinking about these things, these moments, these telesigns, and also these flashbacks that are references to the past of Don Draper's life, and then thinking about time and memory as being nonlinear and subjective, and thinking about all these things within this context of academia, writing a thesis for your master's, and drawing on these philosophers like Deleuze and it's I find from my the work I've done in academia as well that you kind of end up like critiquing the world around you as a result of drawing on these philosophies and like it almost at times being in academia can force you to challenge what you accept as normal. So I was just wondering in what ways working on this thesis has or did kind of like challenge your own idea of your memories or how you experience the world. Did it have a personal effect on you?
Oh, totally. I think one of the reasons I was drawn to Bergson was because I saw parallels between his work and the themes of Mad Men, but also because I totally got his ideas. You know, he has these kind of complicated diagrams of how a memory works that I included in my thesis. And they kind of made sense to me in a way that other philosophy didn't. I mean, I always had a bit of an aversion to theory going through my degree. So it was funny that I embraced his theory so much. But I think it's because it really explained for me my penchant for dwelling on the past.
Right.
Anyone who knows me well knows that I tend to not be able to let go of little things that happen sometimes. And especially my sister can attest to this, right? Hours later, I'll be like, why did I do this, right? Yeah. And I think we all have that where it's hard to kind of mentally remove yourself because the past is always with you, right?
Yeah.
And again, the present is merely the past just bleeding into the future. In fact, Bergson said the present didn't even exist at all.
Yeah.
All we have is our past memories and then like us rolling into the future and always looking forward, right? There's always like people say, oh, you're like a past-minded person or a future-minded person, but who's really present-minded? Like, you don't tend to get that description.
Well, and also there's the reality that there is no present, like, because it takes our mind. I think that they talk about this on, what's that film? The guy who did the Pearl Button. Anyway, this documentary where they are talking about memory and how the present doesn't really exist because by the time your brain processes things fully, it's a second past or a split second past reality. So there actually is no present.
Oh, exactly, right? And it's this idea of we're always carrying the past around with us and it impacts who we are. But also it makes us different people. Like another thing I liked about Bergson is that he said we were constantly changing. We're always in this state of flux because the past moves into our future, that it changes the kind of person that we are, that we're not just static, right?
Absolutely.
Just because we carry these past memories around doesn't mean we're necessarily doomed to repeat ourselves. In fact, it might cause the opposite, right? And especially in Mad Men, we see that with Don, where he kind of starts to embrace the Dick Whitman character, especially towards the end of the season. I mean, in the finale, he hugs this other man in the therapy group in the commune. And I said in my thesis, that was like him hugging himself, right? Being trying to run away from the man that he was to realize that that's who he was, you know, innately. But then it's also, he's not that guy. He's going to be both of them kind of at once, right? We're constantly you know, combining our past selves with the person that we are now and then moving yeah. that into the future. And I really like that. I found it to be a very positive message mm-hmm. in the end, a show that was kind of dark and, you know, mostly about like a kind of depressed alcoholic who keeps yeah. messing up one marriage after another yep. and is really shitty father sometimes, right?
Yeah.
But in the end, it had a kind of this overarching message of like, you can move forward from your past by embracing it.
Mm. And that's something we will continue to talk about because I was surprised to read your optimistic take on the ending
the
of
finale.
The show.
Yeah.
But I obviously haven't thought about it as much as you. So we'll just do a quick music break now, and then we'll return to that topic. Also, the film I could not remember with the help of Google, I have now remembered, quote unquote, is Nostalgia for the Light by Patricio Guzman, who is a phenomenal filmmaker. Anyway, so we are going to listen to a local band named OK Vancouver OK, and this song is from their album Food, Shelter, Water from 2013 and is titled What's My Memory For? Not coincidentally. All right.
This could be one of the big moments in your life. Don't make it your last.
Look, this thing might be bigger than even we think it is.
Do you need an upgrade to the soundtrack to your life? Perhaps a song from a film or a tune from TV? My name is Gap. Exploding Head Movies is here to give you sounds from the cinema, along with the songs that will be defining your future, and those forgotten classics that need a little rescue. Loading Head Movies, Monday, 7 to 9 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
And we're back. This is Alex DeBoer and Molly Lewis on Lady Radio, CITR 101.9 FM. Thanks for still listening. We are here today talking about Molly's honors thesis on Mad Men and memory. And Molly actually just told me, unrelated to this topic, but related to our shared interest in Making a Murderer, that Brendan Dassey is free today.
Well, 90 days.
In 90 days.
Turn it right, which kind of sucks for him. Like, you're acquitted, and now you have to wait 90 days in case we find some reason to keep you in jail.
Is that it? Like, they say that he's acquitted, but not fully. Like, they haven't confirmed he's acquitted.
I think that it's, you know, legal process takes a long. I guess, you know, they're not going to be like, you're free right now, maybe, in case something happens.
Yeah.
But essentially, this is, like, big, because this means that this is, like, a huge break in the case general, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, an advocacy group working for him, right? Mm-hmm. It was, like, for young people who have been wrongly imprisoned.
Coerced confessions.
Yeah. So he has had more luck than Stephen Avery. Did Stephen Avery do it? Who knows? Also, we're talking about Making a Murderer right now, for those who haven't watched it, but you should really watch it. It's on Netflix. It's true crime.
I mean, I'm sure. I think they're making a follow-up.
Are they?
Oh, my God. Somebody should be tracking this, because I think this means that Stephen Avery's case is now going to get a much
someone should be
look.
Deserved look. Although he's appealed to, like, the Supreme Court and tried to get a retrial at least a couple times, I believe, and has been declined. So who knows? But anyway,
world,
good for
wheels,
Brendan Dassey.
You know, they go real slow. I think he spent, what, like 20 years in jail for
an
afternoon with the police where
it's unbelievable.
He was
coerced.
Forced him, confess to something. So, that's a nice silver lining, you know, to a very kind of horrible case.
Yeah.
Kind of a bummer of a documentary. Really interesting.
Honestly,
but,
it was hard to get through that. But
I watched it at Christmas. That was, like,
painful.
The worst idea.
Yeah, totally.
So like the depressing. Holidays, and I'm like, oh, and here are these people wrongfully in jail for years, wasting away.
But at least we found out about Dean Strang and his
normcore.
His normcore style and
that was
his
such a funny, like,
philosophizing on the law. Oh my God, he's like, and he has like a romantic following now as a result of the show. He gets fan mail. Him and the other lawyer are also doing like touring speeches about the show, and I think just about the justice system in America. Mm-hmm. So that's cool.
Yeah, it definitely deserves the attention it's getting now.
Yeah, totally. So back to another show that hopefully people who are listening have watched, Mad Men, directed by Matthew Weiner. So where we left off is Molly was just talking about the finale of the show, which is very interesting. I did watch it. I don't think I watched it live like you did.
Yeah, you went to some screening of it, right?
Yeah, I think that some of my friends and I, we watched it at SFU Woodwards. And anyway, but the ending is very interesting, and that your mom predicted it.
She told me. I said that in
which
the
you mentioned in your thesis, too.
My thesis. My cousin, Tess Lanzarotta, history PhD candidate at Yale, deserves some credit because she had posted a story on Facebook about maybe there'll be a connection between Dawn and Coca-Cola in the finale. And then I told my mom that. I was like, oh, this is what my cousin posted. Mm-hmm. Isn't that an interesting theory? And she said, you know what would be funny if that show ended with that ad of them on the hill all singing. She started singing the song and saying to my dad, remember this? And he's like, yeah, Claire. Right?
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, mom, I don't know if they'd be that literal. Like, okay. And then, of course, the whole show ended with that specific ad that she remembered, which I think is really cool that even it's embedded in her memory, right?
Yeah.
And it actually, I felt, was very suiting for the ending, especially that it's the real thing. It plays on the whole idea of it being this fictionalized show that's set in a real era that we have real memories about.
Yeah.
So
and uses real
so many
archival footage and stuff.
Yeah. It blended the you know, the, as Deleuze would say, the virtual, right, with the real, and it definitely played with those concepts. I was surprised, but I also thought it was, I liked it, right?
I liked it, as well.
Some people did not, and saw it as really cheesy. And
Well, just so for viewers who haven't watched, like, essentially, Dawn is at a kind of meditation
commune
retreat thing in California.
Yeah.
And he joins in the the very last shot is like he's like meditating and he goes om, and then it cuts. There's a smile on his face.
Yeah.
And then it cuts to this Coca-Cola ad from 1971, which is it's the real thing. And it's like, I had never seen that commercial before. But
yeah, me neither, actually.
People of
an
older generation, it's very iconic. Like, your mom knew it. It's like a bunch of people of different ethnicities and nationalities all holding a Coca-Cola up on like a field or something, right? my butchering the commercial.
It's so over the top, but it's like this harmony in terms of like advertising history.
Yeah,
and it was super like successful for Coca-Cola.
And it's it's them like kind of wringing dry the idea of like the 60s and like the harmony and turning it into like
a way to sell
Coca-Cola,
which is so the 70s in a way too, that like the 60s are over, man, let's like profit off of this good feelings and like move into a next generation, especially then leading into the 80s of like crazy business production
worst decade really really the worst decade.
But yeah, I thought
so was, what are the two different readings people have of that ending then?
Well, obviously, it's implying that Dom went on to create this ad. He, I should have maybe mentioned in my breakdown of Mad Men, he works in an advertising agency.
Right. Yeah, I don't know if I mentioned that either.
Again, for
key
those,
to the
Mad
show.
Men is short form for that, right? The men who worked on Madison Avenue, right?
Right.
Doing advertising. And Dom is definitely a creative genius type in the world of creating, like, amazing ad campaigns.
Yeah.
And essentially, what it's showing, it actually goes back to me to the very first episode of the series. And that's why I liked it so much, is that when Dawn's on the Lucky Strike meeting on the very first episode, he has this moment of, I don't know what to pitch, I'm out of ideas. And then all of a sudden, aha, he has it. And that's exactly what they do in the finale, except it's what the idea he has is like the most successful campaign of all time in some people's eyes, which is maybe a bit much on Matthew Weiner's part, right? But definitely I think what it demonstrated was that he was still the same old Dawn, but like I said, but also slightly different at the same time, like a better Dawn, but he still had the same old magic. And it implied that, you know, he had that aha moment while meditating for this great ad, literally looking around, the girl with the braids that works at the retreat is in the ad, right? So they make those connections that like he's literally inspired by his surroundings. Though there's little things, right? The little things that you don't maybe catch the first time.
But so when you say a better Dawn, do you mean a morally more virtuous Dawn, or do you just mean one who's come together with his past more, as you mentioned before?
I would say the latter, because he's a pretty some people hate Dawn. Like there are friends even in my program who, you know, watch a lot of film and television, but Mad Men was hard for them because Dawn can be so unlikable at times.
He can.
So he'll probably go on to have another third wife and cheat on her as well, and you know, but I think in a way him in spiritually might be a bit more whole because he's somewhat embraced who he really is and then came back to what he does well, which is finding inspiration in the world around him that can be profitable. Which that's what people didn't like about it. I remember my the second reader in my for my thesis and who was on my defense, she I mean when I defended she questioned me, right? And her name is Dr. Lisa Coulthard. She teaches here at UBC. And she kind of pushed me on that point because she saw it as very like postmodern and very critical, and that like here's Dawn profiting off the beautiful 60s, right? And it's it's that can have be an ugly side for sure. But I didn't necessarily care so much about that kind of reverberation. I cared so much more about Dawn and his subjectivity and in terms of him embracing himself and doing what he did well. I was worried, you know, people predicted he's gonna die or, you know, this or that. And I was like, no, he's just like going back to doing what Dawn does, right? And for me that was very satisfying for it to kind of come full circle. And that I actually referenced in terms of Bergson's diagrams of a memory are very circular. In that we jump from a present moment to the past, and then we'll take that past moment back into our present. So it literally is a circle, the whole process of recollection. And I felt that the series, that it is a circuit in itself.
It's kind of perfect.
And
it seems to also function on the simple level of television today. And I'm not sure when this trend started, but television having a protagonist who is not a virtuous character. And so in the end, like you say, he maybe grows and benefits financially and as an advertising creative director and maybe as a person who's able to better reconcile his past, but not as the virtuous hero. So it kind of fits with what the whole show is doing from the beginning.
Yeah, that's how I felt for sure, yeah.
Yeah, and I had just looking for a question here that I had. About morality, because I was thinking about this while reading your thesis. Just can't find it. So just from watching Mad Men, just as a viewer, aside from your thesis, the theme of flashback and memory, just like my perception of it watching it, is that it's very haunting, and you use that word in your thesis, but it's haunting in the sense of being primarily or possibly exclusively negative. I think just primarily negative. Like, his memories are generally kind of like guilt and like bad memories, sad memories. So it almost seems like Don is being punished by his own subconscious for his past and for his current mistakes, as he continues to, as you say, make mistakes, cheating on his wife, etc. So do you think, like, what do you think Matthew Weiner's doing in terms of morality with this show? Is this about teaching people to be good people, or what is the role of morality in Mad Men?
I would think from the perspective of a showrunner, and I've been thinking about this a lot because, mm-hmm. as you know, I'm thinking about writing a script and going into the world of more creative television arts. Yeah. But I think from his perspective, you have to give a character background, and for Don to be such a shitty person, as I said earlier, you need to justify it. So by showing him as an orphan who is unloved, mm-hmm. who, you know, his mother died giving birth to him. She's a prostitute, right? Yeah. These are things that he struggled with, mm-hmm. in terms of his own identity. It's a way of, like, you know, padding out his character. But then also everybody has these ugly moments. We don't. And again, when I said earlier that I have a penchant for dwelling on the past, it's usually the bad things that we really carry around with
us. It's kind of human nature.
And I don't think we take enough moments to reflect on the good. And definitely in terms of, like, dramatizing the past, we're going to choose the ugly moments for television purposes, right? That's going to really show depth to the character and also give you maybe a little bit of sympathy, maybe a little bit, although people still didn't like Don, even knowing this about his past. So I think that was maybe Matthew Weiner's point, but also that, you know, nobody's perfect, but it's not like an innate thing. It's something that comes from the way that we're brought up, right?
And
we act a certain way because of things that happened to our past. But again, it's not set in stone. We can change, right?
Yeah.
The future is constantly unfolding.
I totally agree that people tend to reflect and hold on to bad moments, painful moments. So that is kind of human nature, and the show is kind of replicating that. Also, in terms of Don being a bad character, which we are talking a bit about now, I find one of the moments where I like Don the most, and I was thinking about this because you talk a bit about Peggy, who is a key character in the show. She's a woman working at this advertising firm, and she kind of is the one who allows viewers to think about feminism and like the oppression of women and working women. And at one point Peggy gets pregnant and doesn't know she's pregnant, and she ends up delivering the baby. And there's the scene where Dawn is in the delivery or in the hospital with her after she's delivered the baby, and she didn't even realize she was pregnant. So it's like a whole shock, and like, there's all this shame because it's like 1960 and, mm-hmm. and you don't do that. And, this is one of the scenes where Don is redeemable. He's sitting beside her and he's like, this never happened. Like, it'll shock you how much this never happened. And he treats her kind of like an equal in a way that he often doesn't do to women, at least with his romantic relationships with them. I found that was a one of the most redeeming.
It's a huge moment in the show too, because it's like Don really sharing his philosophy of life.
Yeah.
Although I think it's funny that you find that to be redeeming, because in a way it's bad advice. Like, you can't.
Absolutely.
It's good,
and it shows that he doesn't get it.
She can move on, but it's going to cause problems down the line.
Absolutely.
As you said, subconsciously you're going to be tortured because
you
can't blot out the memory completely. You have to put it aside to an extent to get on with your life, but it's still part of you, and it's much better to find a way to embrace the past in a way that benefits the future. And I think that's what he learns throughout the show, is that philosophy was a little bit flawed and also impossible, although I'm sure we all have things we would rather not remember. And that's a very relatable moment. Maybe that's more like we actually have some empathy in that scene for Don, and that we're like, and especially for Peggy, like, we've all had stuff where you're like, I wish that didn't happen. I could just wipe it out of my memory forever. But that's not possible.
And then as you mentioned in your thesis, for Peggy, memory is instigated much the way it is for Dawn in the example of the lighter, where she'll see a symbol of something. And this happens with people. You experience, you smell something, or you see, like in her case, she sees a playground and she'll think about how she's had this child who has gone up for adoption, and, you know, did she do the right thing and all this stuff. And I think that's an interesting memory trigger, which isn't actually visually experienced by the viewers. It's just brought up.
Yeah, the show doesn't often, I don't think it ever goes into anyone's mental memories so much as with Dawn, where we actually see him experiencing memory, usually in the present space, especially in the earlier seasons of his home. That's where the past interrupts him.
Yeah.
And there's certain triggers that are much more subtle. But Peggy, that great line, I think it's Pete that asks her, do you ever think about it? And she's like, playgrounds is her answer. Actually, you know, it's Dawn that says that when they're in the movie theater. Do you ever think about it? Playgrounds.
Yeah.
That's all she says, meaning like she's at a playground. She sees those kids. She can't help but be like, the kid I had that I gave up, because it's the 60s. She's an unmarried secretary. And that was the choice that was kind of made for her in a way. But definitely she felt like maybe she had regrets, right?
Yeah.
And even if she is happy with her decision, it still haunts her, as it would with anybody, right?
Absolutely. So in Mad Men, as we are talking about, the show takes place in the 60s, and there are flashbacks and these telesigns. And so the show is in the past, and it's having flashbacks and links to the past. Also just in, like I said, archival footage, like
the Coke ad.
Yeah, the Coke ad. So we have this past happening in different layers, but at the same time, you talk about how Mad Men is also relevant in the present and kind of about the present, because it's about the viewer's experience watching it. So in what ways is Mad Men about now, and how does it answer this question, how did we get here, which you talk about in your thesis?
Yeah, well, a lot of scholars have looked at Mad Men in terms of its timing, in terms of like what was going on in America beginning back in 2007 when it was airing, and that mirroring some of the same kind of political themes of the 60s. And I don't want to get too much into that because we're not American, but, you know, in terms of watching the show and the viewer's experience, I like to think that all TV becomes part of our memory.
Yeah.
And this is something that really interests me right now, is the whole idea of rewatching shows from our past. So, for example, I love watching retro television. I love rewatching The OC. It was so much fun because I remembered so much of my high school and like what was going on in my life while I was watching it. And I think Mad Men's a show that's going to endure maybe in a better way because it is set in the 60s. So even like 20 years from now, we're still going to watch and think about the past, and then it's going to continue to impact what's going on in the world today. How far have we come, right? And also, you're going to notice, you're going to feel differently about a show. It's this idea that if you watch a show at a different point in your life, it's going to be a different experience, even though you've seen it again and it's familiar, it's triggering a different response. And that, I really liked that concept. I think that's why we like rewatching things, not just to like catch things we didn't catch before, but it's like to create this new experience, one that's rooted in memory, but one that's also unique. And I love that whole concept. And I don't quite understand yet, something I want to look at more in my future research, is why do we keep rewatching? It's not just about binge watching, but also rewatching. And for example, I watch Friends, like the entire season of Friends, every year or so, just because I love it. But I also grew up watching it. I think I watched my first episode in like grade 3 or something. So just each episode has a wealth of memories for me. And it doesn't get old in the sense that as long as enough time has elapsed, it's still fresh, and it creates this kind of like nostalgic but also like uniquely new experience. And I think Mad Men, in it again being set in the past, triggers that, but also in it being so complex, it's going to be found, you know, it's on Netflix now, new viewers are going to experience it, and new viewers are going to keep experiencing it. And I think you can do this with movies, but movies are so short, right? And it's great to rewatch a movie, but to rewatch an entire, like, multiple seasons of a show, that's a lot of hours that you put in. And to do that not once but twice, like, that's a huge life-changing experience in a way. Like, these shows become part of our lives. I said in the paper I gave in Atlanta, my last line was like, we don't just watch television, we make memories with it. And I thought that was a kind of apt way of putting it, that like these shows are, they become part of our memory, and then they become part of our life.
Is that similar, or are you deriving a bit from the comment or the way Dawn sells the carousel Kodak thing? What is the line from that where it's
But he talks about nostalgia.
Yeah,
like
nostalgia.
A twinge in your heart. And he says that nothing is more powerful than nostalgia. And my response to him is that, well, memory is more powerful than nostalgia. Nostalgia is just like the fuzzy feely, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of fleeting. That's my impression of it, at least. You know, that's like the emotions that are brought up when you, like, smell a cigar or something and you think of your grandfather, and it's super brief, you know? Yeah. But memory is so much more powerful in that you can't escape it. Mm-hmm. It's not, like, random the way that nostalgia is. It's really something that, like, can burden you, right?
Yeah.
Where nostalgia seems to be a lot less. I said to Dawn, I was like, he's not nostalgic. It's memory that's destroying him.
Yeah.
And he's just using that to sell, right?
Yeah.
And he's kind of, like, twisting the whole concept of memory for his own benefits, when really what he struggles with most is his memory.
Absolutely.
And the reality of his past, not just the warm, fuzzy feelings that it conjures up, because he doesn't have any warm, fuzzy feelings about his past.
Not really. And I agree with you, and we have already talked a bit about, but this idea of serialized television and how you can't do the same things with a movie. And you say in your conclusion, more and more viewers are turning to television for intellectual and emotional stimulation, fits with what you've been talking about. I feel like the format of having more time and like having something be part of a whole gives you space to engage with people so much more. I mean, not to knock films, but like I found lately, for me, the most powerful things I've been watching have been miniseries. I really like that format.
Making a Murderer, right? Which is a sensation, right?
Yes.
That's not a movie.
Yeah, so even shorter ones, too, that are like 6 episodes. I've been watching quite a few. There was one that was 4 episodes produced by the BBC on Netflix. What is that one called again? It's like about this English town. Anyway, the format itself of serialized television can be very powerful. And again, from your conclusion, I really liked how you brought up Sally's so Sally is Don Draper's daughter. She's the oldest of his 3
Played
children.
By Kiernan Shipka.
Yep. Right? Yes. And she starts out being like 4 and is 14 by the end, or the series spans 11 years, right? And in your conclusion of your thesis, you bring up how Sally, this little girl's concept of forever, is the image of the Land O'Lakes Butterbox, which is like a little Native American girl holding a box with an image of herself on it, and then an image of herself on that. And I was just going to ask you, how is an image repeating itself eternally sort of an ideal way to summarize Mad Men as a series?
I used it to say that it could be re-experienced, because I think it's definitely, as I was just saying, a show that deserves revisiting. And I think it'll be really interesting to see if it continues to endure in the future. I think it will. I think it's going to find new fans down the line. Again, it wasn't embraced by everybody, but I think it does have a bit of a niche audience, and I think it's going to find more fans down the line. But also this idea, too, that the whole story kept going in my mind, right? I've said to you, we don't know what's going to happen to Don in terms of his life at the end of the show, but we do know he's going to go on to create that Coca-Cola ad. And in a way, we can kind of imagine, like, it's kind of playful, at least for me. It opened up a lot of possibilities in my mind about where the show would go. And so for me, I felt that image of kind of it's continuing on with something that Matthew Weiner would have embraced in terms of, like, and Don's continuing on. And he's going to be kind of the same, but kind of different. And for people, who, especially viewers who spent a lot of time with him like me, we can imagine what his life would be like. And that seems to endure eternally. But also, the show is going to endure, right? We're going to be able to revisit it whenever we want on Netflix. And that's something I think, again, movies are short. Like, we can rewatch a movie, and there's certain movies I love to rewatch, like Wes Anderson movies, for example. Yeah. They never get old for me. But there's something different about TV, and I think it's because of the time that you invest with it. It does become a lot more of your life. And I find, especially from working in an office the last year or so, that people tend to talk more about TV. Mm-hmm. It is more of our lives, you know, apart from the, you know, obviously as a film studies student, I talked with a lot of people about movies, but what I really love to talk about is TV. And I love that that's something I can talk with anybody about.
Yeah.
Right. Even the high schoolers who I was teaching in a course just a few weeks ago, right? What's your favorite TV show was my icebreaker question, right?
Yeah.
I love that we can discuss it. And I spend a lot more of my own life watching TVs and movies, even though my degree is in film studies, in fact.
Yeah.
I wrote my thesis on TV. It's kind of weird that my degree is in film studies, right?
Sure.
It should really be media studies. UBC, get on
UBC.
That. Right? Or cinema and media and television, or television, radio, cinema, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, it should be broader. Because,
although I find this kind of interesting what you're saying, because in your thesis you also talk about how cinema is more of a collective experience. Like, you go to see a movie and you're part of a sort of community of the audience, and television is something you can experience alone. But because television is more accessible to people through avenues like Netflix and broadcast television versus maybe a film that's has a small distribution.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, TV is a great way for people to connect.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, like, the Cinematheque, right, which we frequent, like, it has its own community built into it, and
totally.
That is why people love cinema.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think TV being much more of a touching point, right, like a point of discussion that we can all kind of share, it is collective in a way, even though we tend to watch it on our own.
Mm-hmm.
And I just like it, especially with Netflix, that we can share, oh, well, have you seen this? Well, it's on Netflix.
Yeah.
So next time I see you, better have watched it.
Yeah.
And that's what it was like in my office. I kept pestering one of my coworkers. You got to watch Making a Murderer. You got to watch The People versus O.J. Simpson.
Yeah.
Like, I know you. I know you're going to love these shows. And more importantly, you have to watch it so we can talk about it.
Oh, my God.
To make the workday pass faster.
We should probably have an episode on The People versus O.J. Or no, O.J. Made in America.
Or O.J. Made
in
America.
No, that one's
or
way
both,
better.
Or both, right? Why are we so interested? Again, talk about the past. Why are we so interested in O.J. Simpson right now? Like,
that series, O.J. Made in America, produced by ESPN, for all who have not watched it, you got to watch it. It's so interesting.
Seven hours of thought-provoking material.
Phenomenal
nonfiction. Great use of archival footage.
Some
of the stuff, especially the O.J., like, college USC OJ, right? To see that footage, I never had that concept of him being such a, like, football American hero. So to see that on the ESPN documentary, I thought was really cool. And you want to talk about the past and journey into the present, right? Here we are watching him playing football years and years ago today, thinking about it and thinking about his reverberation in popular culture down today, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And it's similar also with Mad Men, that for people in our generation who are in their 20s, all you have is kind of like a few words or a phrase you've heard that's in your mind, but you don't know any of the context. Like, knowing, like, oh, I knew the words Rodney King. Like, I knew that, but I didn't know that he was beaten like that. I didn't see that footage. I didn't know, like, I knew O.J. Simpson had, like, murdered someone. He'd murdered his wife or something. I'd hear my parents be like, oh, he murdered her, but I didn't know anything about it. And it's kind of like with Mad Men, too. A lot of the stuff is like, oh, yeah, I remember when... I remember people talking about, like, the first time a man walked on the moon, or when JFK was shot, but maybe you don't fully know, so.
Oh, and to see it happen in a show that fictionalizes it, but it's the fiction is based on historical events, which, definitely gives you a bit better understanding, especially of political figures. Just the episodes, especially where JFK was shot, Robert Kennedy was shot.
Yeah.
These are things we all know are important events, but to see characters who we spent so much time with react just makes it come alive again. Again,
totally.
The past coexisting with the present. That's a perfect demonstration of it.
And we're going to have to wrap this up because we are out of time. But thank you to everyone for listening, and Molly for joining us.
Thank you for having
me. And sharing your time. This is CITR 101.9 FM. Please keep listening. And we'll end with the Mad Men opening credits again.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks, everyone.